This is Sciographies, an introduction to the people who make science happen. I'm your host, David Barkley. I'm an oceanographer with the Faculty of Science here at Dalhousie University. And on Sciographies, I interview different types of scientists about what shaped their interests, their career path, and how they get their research ideas. Welcome to another episode of Sciographies. This time we're talking to Dr. Jason Brown. He's a professor here at Dal in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics. In his free time, Dr. Brown is also a musician and a songwriter. He's been performing in front of live audiences for decades, and he's recorded a number of albums. So, of course, he has crossed the streams of his music interests and his mathematical interests and done lots of research into the music and the mysteries behind the Beatles. In 2004, he made big headlines when he used the power of mathematics to unravel which notes were being played by which instruments in the opening chord of A Hard Day's Night. In this episode, Dr. Brown tells us about his early days playing live music in Toronto and in Calgary, a couple Stampede gigs in there, attending university, real-world applications of graph theory, and of course, you know we're going to talk about the Beatles. One of the things I'm sort of interested in is just how you ended up as a mathematician. So I need the origin story. You're a Torontonian.
Yes, I am.
Born and raised.
Yep.
Now, we need to know which neighborhood, because this is the reality of Toronto these days. Which neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in North York.
Okay, North York. Okay. Obviously, you know, a big part of your research is connected to music. So Right. Were you involved in music at a young age?
I was. I started off on violin, and then I moved to piano. And I was one of those students who used to just practice the half hour before his lesson every week to see if he could fool his teacher. And I never really loved the piano at that point. But then around the age of 12, I heard the Beatles' Red and Blue albums. And I threw away the piano and decided to teach myself guitar. And I used to spend 8 to 10 hours a day in the summer while I was in high school with the Beatles records and my guitar. And that was the start of really my musical awakenings.
8 to 10 hours a day every summer from when you were 12. So you got that 10,000 hours in, right?
I got those in early, yes.
But you ended up a mathematician, not a musician.
Right.
Do you come from a musical household?
My mother didn't play any music. So my grandfather, my father's side, was a music teacher. He taught music. He also had a mandolin orchestra in his day.
Wait, hang on a second. So how many mandolins are we talking?
I'm thinking it would have been about 10 to 15 mandolins. So, you know, he was very musical. My father, unfortunately, when he was young, a doctor made a mistake and perforated one of his eardrums. So he was deaf in one ear. But I could always tell he was very musical. He loved music. And when I started to play music, my other brothers and sister did as well. And he would love to record us.
Okay.
And I had a band with my brothers and sister. He would come and mix the sound.
Okay. And was he taking you out to concerts at all? Were you going downtown?
No, he didn't. He didn't take us out to any concerts. He was very busy. Both he and my mom had a business. You know, I had my records. I had an older brother who was very accomplished on an instrument called the vibraphone. Mm-hmm. He would play a lot of jazz, and he got into playing in clubs. So when I turned about 16, I would sometimes join him and accompany him on guitar, and that would be playing all sorts of music. It would be jazz. It would be popular music. It would be sometimes very fast classical numbers.
Okay. And this is your older brother was how much older?
9 years older.
Okay. So he was considerably older.
Yes.
He brings you along. He's the one who introduced you to the seedy underbelly of live music.
The fun underbelly of live music.
Okay. You're going around playing music with your brother.
Yes.
What's the scene like?
There were some clubs in Toronto. There were a lot of opportunities to play, and I was sort of pushed to play a lot of different music, but a lot of good music, but not the kind of music that necessarily rock musicians would play.
Right, okay.
Then after high school, my family and I moved to Calgary. I went to the University of Calgary to do my undergraduate. And there, it was the early 1980s. It was boom time in the city. And we played in lots and lots of bars.
Okay. I'm just trying to imagine those cities in those times and what was going on.
I think it was the beginning of the oil boom when I moved out in 1980. There was sort of a drop around 84 when I left, but in between it was pretty good. And there was a lot of money to hire musicians. Mm-hmm. And every summer there'd be Stampede. And during Stampede, I'd often play in three different places. And it would be about 12 hours.
Wow.
And it would be exhausting that week.
Now, was it like the Blues Brothers, were you just playing Rawhide, like, and people were throwing beer bottles at you? Or
there were some places when we played on the outskirts of Calgary and elsewhere in Alberta, where I remember one place there was a big sign at the door with a knife with a red circle with a line through it, and it said, check your knives. So there were some tough places that I played in, but you had to play the music that they wanted to hear. And yeah. So I even learned banjo while I was out there, enough to play Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Okay.
And it became necessary to learn country music out there.
Okay. And so during this time, you were studying mathematics at U of C.
Yes. Yeah. I was studying mathematics. And during some of the summers, I would travel to play music, but as well, I'd be doing research.
Okay.
Because mathematics is the kind of thing where you don't need to be in a lab setting. You can do your research wherever you are.
Mm-hmm. Did you steer the family towards Calgary? You were looking at universities and thinking?
You know, in retrospect, I think it was because, you know, I was the one graduating at that time and I had an offer from the University of Calgary, but I had offers elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I think we just felt as well for the musical part that Calgary was a good place. And it was. It was very hard to break into the scene in Toronto. But in Calgary, as soon as we went out, we were working in bars.
Okay. And this was a whole family business. I mean, other than your parents, this was all the siblings playing?
This was all the siblings playing.
Yeah, so a family band.
Yes.
Now, we got to talk names. Did you guys have any funny good band names?
My father wanted us to be named Sweet Mix, but we said no to that. And we ended up with the name Nightbreaker.
That sounds like Calgary in the 80s, Nightbreaker.
Yeah, it was probably a good name at the time.
Yeah. So it sounds like your parents were pretty supportive of all the children going out and playing music all the time.
Right. You know, I think the thing that we got from our parents is that, you know, if someone offers you an opportunity, you say yes first and then you worry about doing it. You know, there's so many people who say no as a gut reaction to new experiences and they miss out on a lot because they're always afraid that they're not quite ready.
Now, the real question is, do you bring this philosophy over to your research? Are you saying yes to things that are new all the time?
Oh, I think I do. You know, one of the things that I've tried to do throughout my career is to try to be as broad as I can be and try to be as interdisciplinary as I can be. And that's, I think, a difficult thing. The easiest thing is to be as deep as possible in a narrow area, and you can become the expert in that area. It's much harder to learn a variety of different areas and to try to combine them. And it's a little bit risky because you don't know if it's going to pay off, but it's much more rewarding. Not everything works out in that setting, but, you know, if it does work out, it can be very beautiful and perhaps important.
Yeah. I want to go a little bit backwards again. So you have this, which to me sounds like an idyllic undergraduate experience. You're doing research in the summers, you're playing music, making buckets of cash during Stampede, I'm sure. And of course, pursuing this mathematics degree. Do you have any recollection of how you chose mathematics?
Yeah, it's kind of odd because I think what happened when I got to university, I knew I wanted to do sciences, but I decided I didn't want to spend hours in the lab. And so that threw out biology and chemistry and physics. And so I was gravitating more and more towards mathematics. So what sealed the deal was doing research in my second year during the summer and finding out, you know, that there is new things to do in mathematics. I remember that summer I was funded by an NSERC grant and my supervisor said, how about working on graphs? And to me, graphs were, you know, plots.
Yeah.
But he gave me a textbook to read. And it was on graphs and networks. And graphs are mathematical objects where there are points and lines joining them. It's a very simple model, but a very important model. And I fell in love with the topic.
Now, to put some context, maybe for the listeners, most people have probably seen graph theory from the film Good Will Hunting. This is the problem that's on the chalkboard has to get solved, right?
And it's actually close to my area. That's between graph theory and algebra. It's called algebraic combinatorics.
Yeah, Matt Damon. The janitor. Who would have thunk? Okay, so the graph theory was obviously super important because you that's like your main area of research. And you did a PhD at U of T.
Yes.
Now, in computer science, or you had
in mathematics.
In mathematics, but with a supervisor in computer science, right?
So
it was a graph theory guy.
Because the thing is that graph theory is a relatively new field of mathematics. And because it has lots of applications, especially to computer science, the researchers who work in graph theory can be in a variety of different departments, sometimes in the mathematics department, sometimes in computer science, and even in places like engineering or in optimization and business.
Right. Now, in layman's terms, like you were explaining, graph theory is simply drawing points and lines between the points and all the different ways you can do that. Is that correct?
Right. You know, and depending on the problem, understanding how you might model your problem with the graph. So for instance, you know, one problem might be that you want to send garbage trucks up and down the streets of the city to pick up garbage. You don't want them retracing a road. That's one area. Or it might be that you have a company where what you do is you produce different tanks of chemicals and gases. And for certain reasons, you don't want to store in a warehouse chemicals that interact with one another. For instance, you wouldn't want to store the hydrogen tanks with the oxygen tanks because if there's a leak in both, everything will explode. So how many warehouses do you need? You can view this as your chemicals are your points. You join two if they're incompatible and being the same warehouse. Your warehouses are colors that you attach to the points, and you want to know what's the fewest number of colors you need to color the graph such that if two points are joined, they get different colors. And exactly the same problem is used at the university to schedule examinations at the end. And there your points are different courses, final exams, and you join two if a student takes both courses so that they're incompatible for being scheduled at the same time. So you can often have two widely different problems like scheduling and warehouse assignments that come down to the same theoretical problem on graphs. And I would study, in general, the more abstract problem in the hopes of applying it to both areas.
Right. The more general the problem is, the more it can be applied to many different things.
Exactly.
I'm a little bit interested in your transition. So you did this, so you did your PhD in a few years, you're saying? Two, 3 years?
2 years.
2 years. So that's got to be some sort of record.
I think it was the quickest one in the math department at U of T.
Probably still stands, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then was it right to Dow after that? Or did you have
No, I did a year as a postdoc out in Waterloo. Then I did 5 years at York in Toronto. And then this job opened up at Dalhousie, and it was a great move.
You had this background where you had you were playing lots of music, but you had a very strong academic career. And at some point, you decided to marry the two. How did that happen?
So it happened in 2003, I guess, on the cusp of 2004, which was to be the 40th anniversary of the movie A Hard Day's Night with the corresponding song. And at that point, I thought back to the opening chord. And, you know, I had seen in many music books over the years, I had hunted down how was the chord played. And everyone had a different idea. It was this way. It was that way. It was a bar chord at the third fret. No, here are some other fingers. Maybe someone thought some of the other Beatles were playing. But it was all subjective. And I thought at that point, well, I'm a mathematician. Maybe there's a scientific way. And I had read years earlier a book that talked about the physics and mathematics of sound. And talked about Fourier transforms, which is an algorithm that allows you to take a sound and decompose it into its frequencies and its amplitudes, which is essentially breaking it down into its trigonometric components. And so then I actually took part of the opening chord and ran it through the algorithm and started to make deductions. And I almost gave up because there were about 30,000 frequencies in there. But I could start to make some deductions because undoubtedly the notes that they played were amongst the loudest frequencies. And I knew, you know, George Harrison played a 12-string guitar. Very quickly, I found out that it really wasn't playable just on the 12-string guitar. But even if I added in John's 6-string and Paul's bass, it wasn't enough. And then I thought about an assumption that I had made. And this is what you constantly do in research. What are your assumptions? My assumption was that it was just the Beatles playing. And what happens if it was another instrument? In particular, I had three frequencies all about the same. I couldn't attribute it to anyone. What about if those three frequencies came from a piano, which typically has three strings under each note? So I ran down to a music store. I stuck my head in the grand pianos and started counting strings. Before I got thrown out, I found out that where they played the note could have indeed come from a piano, that it was in the right range. And so that's where I began to, you know, incorporate mathematics into my analysis of music.
And the punchline of the story was that George Martin was playing the piano, the producer, George Martin.
Yes, George Martin was playing the piano, undoubtedly, on the opening chord of A Hard Day's Night. It's actually, he's playing a cluster of notes. Mm-hmm. A number of them are not being played by any of the other Beatles. And it's very much like something that a classical composer like Bartok might play.
Okay.
George Martin was trained classically. This is something that he added to the Beatles. You know, yeah. He could sit down and add a chord cluster and mix it perfectly into the mix so that you really didn't hear the piano. And yet it created the sound that was really, it couldn't be reproduced by bands unless you knew there was a piano there and unless you knew what notes.
So I'm wondering, are you going to write the perfect Beatles song using an algorithm generated by your understanding of the statistics?
I have tried this.
Okay.
So I did an album called Songs in the Key of Pi. It's up on iTunes. And it's all my own songs. And one of the songs is called A Million Whys, which is the song that I wrote in the style of the early Beatles. Taking not only the principles that I learned from their work, but also stretch them in, mm-hmm. in certain ways. So for instance, the Beatles had this notion of a bridge which they called the middle eight, because it's typically eight bars long. In the middle of the song, it's a change. Something new happens there. I wanted to figure out, could I stretch the idea of a bridge from being a middle eight? And when I look at the Beatles' work, the bridge, while it was never, wasn't often 8 bars long exactly, it was always shorter than the verse choruses. So mm-hmm. I thought, why not write a song where I try to make the bridge longer than the verse choruses? That would be unusual. It's something the Beatles didn't do, but it was sort of along the lines of learning from them the importance of a bridge. So that's what I did in this song. As well, they have that little stumble at the beginning of I Want to Hold Your Hand, ba ba ba. What they do there is actually they do a little trick on the audience where if you're a listener, you assume without any other clues that the song starts on beat one. But they didn't do that. They did a mathematical transformation and moved back the pattern instead of starting on beat one, starting on the and after three. And so what I did is in my song, I had a little pattern of threes that I played over. It would be natural to start on beat one, but I cut away the first three. She's got a million reasons. So those kind of things.
So these are very analytical tricks that you're putting into your songwriting.
Right.
Not so much different than, say, a great songwriter
right.
would do.
Right.
But have you ever just approached it purely mathematically?
I have. So, you know, one of the things that I did was I looked at Chuck Berry's lead guitar playing. So let me give you an example.
Okay.
Pull out my guitar here. So this is something like Chuck Berry's guitar playing. That little part there are actually groupings of threes. Mm-hmm. Over the underlying groupings of twos and fours. And I noticed that Chuck Berry, who's known for what's called his duck walk, he would get down low and skedaddle across the stage. Yeah. He does that precisely when he does these patterns of threes against the fours because it's so cool. And on the other hand, what you need to do subconsciously or consciously is understand how many patterns of threes equals how many patterns of fours. So this is a greatest common divisor problem, and Chuck Berry does it naturally, so it ends out right.
Right.
It ends off properly.
Because the duck walk is in three, right?
Yes, and it's the threes against the fours that is a mathematical move, but it's so powerful that it moves him emotionally.
Right.
That he has to go move across the stage. And so what I decided to do, well, Chuck Berry does these patterns of threes against the background patterns of fours and twos. What about doing something new? How about a pattern of five?
Okay.
And so what I did was explicitly decide to write a riff in a pattern of five because it was a natural to play.
All right.
And I practiced it until I could play it. So it goes something like this. So I often play that when I give math and music talks, and I have a band of professional musicians playing with me, and they have a hell of a time trying to play along because their brain doesn't hear the patterns of fives on top of the rock rhythm of twos and fours.
Sure.
So there was a perfect example of where I decided, let the mathematics dictate what should sound right, and then practice it until I could play it naturally.
So you do these musical demos, these guitar demos at public talks. How does the audience usually respond?
People are interested in the story of how mathematics plays a role in music. I should say some people. I also get angry emails from musicians who hate the idea that mathematics is involved in their music. They taught mathematics was just calculations. It's the antithesis of creativity. So I'm saying their work isn't creative. But mathematics is none of that.
Right.
It's really a hugely creative endeavor.
Yeah, I think when you get down to research, it's hugely creative. And so of course there's a connection between music and mathematics, you know. But I'm wondering, is there also a connection between your lifelong passion of playing music and research itself? Do you think there's a connection creativity-wise there?
I think there is. You know, I have some general principles that permeate both my mathematical research and my musical songwriting. You know, this idea of being as broad as possible. So I have a lot of appreciation for different kinds of music. I like combining them. I like analyzing them. And it's the same thing in my mathematics, that I like combining things. It's just something that's attractive to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you've also written a couple of books. So a completely different creative endeavor.
Right.
So in one of your books, you discuss the numerical background of why certain things happen.
Right. Mathematics for the Liberal Arts, which is aimed at the students who have to take a math course. So it's under duress and trying to explain to them why mathematics, a little bit of mathematics, would enhance their lives and why mathematics is a story.
Yeah.
Mathematics isn't just research. Mathematics is not boring. But mathematics often can permeate a story and make a story more interesting.
So in that textbook, you cover some very pertinent examples, right? So you talk about, for example, the Lac-Mégantic.
Yeah. So there the story was, I think it was 2013, where this train full of flammable oil was parked outside this town. The engineer set the brakes to most of the cars, which is what they typically did. The brakes failed and the train ran into the city, and I think it killed over 50 people. But trying to understand that, it could have been avoided because the owner was very quick to blame the engineer on the train. But what I put forward in the chapter, and this is on risk and decision making, is that everyone has a probability of making an error. And the owner of the train company had been cutting back on the number of engineers per train. So instead of having a few engineers on the train, he was down to one. And if, you know, that engineer has, say, a 5% chance of making an error and not setting the brakes properly, well, that's a 5% error, and that can have, as we see, devastating consequences. But if you have independently two engineers checking, then the probability goes down quite a bit. And if you have three engineers checking independently, it goes down even further. It's this idea in mathematics that, you know, having independent checks is a way to really drive the error down.
Mm-hmm. Probabilities multiply.
Right.
That's what it comes down
to. Independent probabilities multiply. Exactly.
Well, I've always thought of this one thing that happened, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. The pitcher Randy Johnson. Does it ring a bell?
I know the pitcher. Remember the beard?
Yeah, the fastest left-hander of all time. Mm-hmm. He threw a pitch and it hit a bird in mid-flight. Have you ever seen this?
I think I have seen that, yes.
And I just think, well, how many years of how many teams, how many years, how many pitches needed to be thrown for that to happen?
Right. I mean, I think it's, you know, this is the basis for people when they have strange coincidences and they attach meaning to them. But, you know, so many occurrences happen in everyone's life, and most of them lead to nothing. You know, it's bound to happen probabilistically that you will have some of these coincidences just by chance. But people attach meaning, and this is part of, I guess, our human nature, that we seek meaning in everything that happens, even if it's just random.
Right. So this is how we end up getting angry emails if we say that life has no meaning. But maybe not. Okay. Yeah. I have another question that I have to ask. So this film came out. Yes. I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yesterday. Yep.
Okay. Now, in a hypothetical universe where the Beatles never existed and we're in the present year, 2019, and the music is the same as it is, and someone wrote Obladee, do you think it would be a hit?
I don't know if that particular song would be a hit, but I think many of their songs would be. I think I Want to Hold Your Hand.
So you still think that the Beatles would, if their songs were released today, would be as big as they were in 1964?
Yes, even though music has changed since then, I think it's the mathematics inherent in their music that mm-hmm. makes it eternal. There's a beautiful quote due to Bruce Springsteen who says that the mathematics in the Beatles' music is elegant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's not a mathematician, but he recognizes two things, that there's mathematics in the Beatles' music and it's elegant.
Yeah.
You know, so there is something universal about certain properties, I think mathematical properties in the best music, and it's beyond time.
Now, kind of as an extension to that, there's many people, you know, in many musicians and composers who have taken that to the nth degree, right? So you have your Steve Reich or whatever who focus very narrowly on mathematics mm-hmm. to generate music.
Right.
So does that argument, is it kind of a circular argument? It goes too far and then we get into the world of bad music or?
Yeah, I think so.
No
I
offense mean, to Steve Reich if
right,
he's listening.
Too much mathematics may be a problem. There is something known in aesthetics as the inverted U-shape. Mm-hmm. Where if you try to map on the horizontal axis complexity versus on the vertical axis aesthetics,
yeah,
that there's a sweet spot. We don't like music that's too simple. None of us, you know, as adults like to listen to nursery rhymes. Mm-hmm. And we don't like to listen to things that are too complex. You don't like to listen to Schoenberg's 12-tone music, atonal music.
Mm-hmm. So there's despite a sweet its spot. Mathematical perfection.
Right, it's mathematically perfect. But it's perhaps too perfect. And so there is a sweet spot for us where between simple and complex. Mm-hmm. And I think the Beatles found that sweet spot. I don't know how the Beatles hit it, but they repeatedly hit that sweet spot.
Right. Maybe just not with Obladee Obladee.
Maybe. I like that song, but it's I wouldn't put that forward as their best song.
Okay. So obviously, I think you would say you're a fan, a Beatles fan.
Yes.
How do you feel about the Rolling Stones?
I like the Rolling Stones. I don't find that they have as much breadth as the Beatles, and I think I really appreciate the breadth.
We're an explosion of data. People talking about big data all the time. So, of course, we must also be an explosion of the uses of mathematics.
Yes. You know, I think the future of mathematics for a lot of students and the best jobs that will be available and careers that will be available will be in data science and machine learning. And both of those require a strong background in mathematics. Many areas, or perhaps every area outside of mathematics, will be clamoring for students who can handle that both on an applied setting, but be able to do some research in that area to develop new techniques.
Well, thanks to this week's guest, Dr. Jason Brown. Next week, we'll be talking to Dr. Alistair Simpson, an evolutionary biologist who has recently discovered a new branch on the tree of life. If you're enjoying the show, make sure you subscribe to Sciographies so that you're notified instantly when new episodes are made available. And of course, please consider rating and reviewing us. I'm your host, David Barclay. Thanks for listening. Sciographies is brought to you by Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science and CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The show is a legacy project that came out of Dalhousie's bicentennial anniversary celebrations in 2018. Our producer is Nicole Killowee. You can learn more about Sciographies at dal.ca/sciographies.